Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to welcome you all here. I have great pleasure in introducing to you Professor Anne Davis, who is marvellous. She's marvellous in many ways. She is a woman of many talents because she writes on labour law, European law, and public law. And her strength lies in the beautiful clarity with which she writes, and the fact that she's able to bring ideas from the different disciplines and pull them together. So it's a great privilege for us to have her here. And without further ado, I'll give the floor over to Anne. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. I know it's getting towards the end of term and everyone is exhausted. And thank you, Catherine, for that kind introduction, to which I fear I may not live up. But anyway, here we go. So, what I want to do today is talk about the Court of Justice, and I want to talk about its decisions in labour law cases. From the perspective of the literature on labour courts. So let me give you a little bit of background to start with, and then I'll explain why I think this is a useful framework for analysis. I should say that because I've got roughly half an hour to talk in, this may end up sounding like a rather more blunt and aggressive paper than it actually is in its full written version, because just in order to get through in the time, I probably won't be able to get quite all the caveats and qualifications in that exist in the main paper, so please do bear that in mind. So many countries choose to resolve labour disputes by entrusting them to specialist labour courts. Of course, for those of you who know the UK, we have a system of employment tribunals which deal with individual employment disputes between a worker and his or her employer. Other countries use them for collective labour disputes, so to resolve disagreements about the interpretation of a collective agreement, for example. The Norwegian Labour Court is a good example of that. And there are some countries in which labour courts decide both types of dispute. So why is it that people think that there's a need to entrust labour law cases to specialist courts? Well, there's an interesting paper by McCarthy in which he identifies four justifications for this. Firstly, the informality of proceedings, or the possibility of having informal proceedings. This is mainly a criterion that he's thinking about in terms of first instance decision making, dispensing with wigs and gowns and all the sort of normal legal paraphernalia, in the hope that workers and unions will find these courts an easy place to go to make use of and to represent themselves. A second reason he identifies is the autonomy of labour law. And this is to some extent a sort of UK-specific issue. McCarthy's concern here was that the ordinary courts, with their emphasis on freedom of contract and individualism, were not necessarily achieving Parliament's intended results when interpreting labour law statutes. And so he argued that specialist courts would be better at identifying and realising Parliament's intentions. But I think this is very much a UK-specific issue, and I'm going to leave that on one side. So McCarthy's other two criteria are the ones I'm going to really be focusing on, and they are expertise and flexibility. So when he talks about expertise, he means one of two possibilities, really. Either that you appoint expert judges who already know something about labour law or labour market institutions to your labour court, or, even if you can't manage that, that the people who are appointed to the labour court will develop that sort of expertise over time. So expertise in the sense of a good understanding of the labour market context. And flexibility, the fourth criterion, and what he means by that is that your labour court will hopefully focus on developing solutions to problems that will work effectively in practice. So thinking about the practical consequences or impact of the decisions that they make. Will this ruling be something that employers will find easy to interpret and apply on the ground, for example? So in a legal system that doesn't have specialist labour courts, we might use these criteria as a starting point for looking at the general court system and how it performs in labour cases, and therefore whether the introduction of a specialist labour court might be justified. And that's what I'm going to try and do with some of the case law of the Court of Justice. Of course, an important question arises as to why we single out labour law for this sort of special treatment, because of course there are lots of other specialist areas of law which might make similar claims. And of course I'm not qualified to make that kind of assessment of a whole range of different areas, but I'll return to that point right at the end of the paper and just say something about it again then. So let me turn to the Court of Justice then and think about my criteria a little bit more specifically in that context, because there are various problems and objections to my methodology that I would like to address. So I'm not going to say anything about autonomy of labour law, because I've already said that I think that's a quite UK-specific issue. I'm also not going to say anything about informality of proceedings, because of course the Court of Justice is not a first instance decision maker, so that's not something we need to worry about. So my two relevant criteria then are expertise and flexibility. So the first question I'm going to be asking about the case law that I'm going to consider is, does the Court of Justice show a good understanding of labour market institutions in its decisions? Now, it's important to emphasise, and that this is a really, really serious caveat now, this does not necessarily mean that what we might term the labour interest should necessarily prevail in every case. I'm not necessarily talking about outcomes here. What I am talking about is that the decision should not be based on misunderstandings about labour institutions and how they work. And so I'm talking about the reasoning process as much as I am about the outcome. Of course, given the court's reasoning style, its reasoning process can be sometimes rather difficult to discern. But sometimes it does make plain the assumptions on which it's basing its decisions. And of course, sometimes we can get help from the Advocate General's opinion. My second criterion is flexibility. Does the court give any consideration to the practical outcomes of its decisions? And of course, again, there's an objection to this, which is that you could argue that the court doesn't resolve cases. It gives rulings on EU law, and it's the national court which provides the final resolution of the case. But as we all know, its rulings often don't give very much room for manoeuvre, and so I don't think it's irrelevant to consider what the practical implications of decisions are and whether the court appears to have given any thought to them. What I'm going to do in a minute is apply those two criteria to a selection of cases. I want to consider two broader objections to my approach before I do so. The first one is that it's wrong to talk about the court. It's wrong to sort of personify the court because there are 27 judges now, it sits in chambers, it doesn't have a single outlook now, if it ever did. And I suppose there's something in that, there's some truth in that. But of course, if we take that view, I think that would lead us to the conclusion that we can't examine the case law at all, because each decision is just a decision on its specific facts in the particular case. And that doesn't do justice to the court's own attempts to try and achieve some degree of consistency in its outlook and some degree of sort of pattern in its case law. So I think it's not an insurmountable problem. The second objection is that the court itself is a specialist court. It's a specialist court in the subject called EU law. And so it's really not fair to be analysing it in terms of its appreciation of issues in labour law, because it is already a specialist court. And of course, that's an opinion that's mirrored in the way that we teach the subject. We have courses on EU law, and those of us who teach EU law as part of courses on labour law or taxation or whatever might sometimes be seen as amateurs, and I certainly sometimes feel like one. But I think a more mature view of EU law would recognise that it is now pervasive in a variety of different fields. And just as EU law impacts on a variety of different fields, it's now no longer possible to just work on the assumption that those different fields of law and their sort of outlook and methods and so on will not have an impact in turn on EU law. So the impact might be in both directions. I think it's unrealistic now to try and preserve the sort of purity of EU law as a closed system in its own right. So what I'm going to do now is say something about the court's understanding of labour market institutions, and then I'm going to say something about the practical consequences of its decisions. I'll then consider a couple of possible explanations for some of the difficulties I'm going to identify before drawing some conclusions. So I'm going to begin, obviously, I think, by talking about the court's understanding of collective bargaining as a feature of the labour market. And I know that this is the moment at which I'm probably expected to launch into Viking and Laval, so I'm going to start with working time, just to confuse everybody. So I want to talk about a case called Robinson Steele. It's a case about rolled-up holiday pay. Rolled-up holiday pay is where the employer, instead of paying people at the time at which they take their holidays, pays them a little tiny extra amount in their weekly or hourly pay in order to cover their paid holiday time. It has some administrative convenience for the employer. It can, of course, be problematic from the point of view of the workers if they don't get a genuine extra amount of money to cover their holidays. It might also deter them from actually taking holiday, because when they do so, they don't get paid. And if you're a low-paid worker, it's probably pretty unrealistic to suggest that you're going to save up your tiny little extra bits of money in order that you can then afford to take some holiday. So the Court of Justice ruled in Robinson Steele that rolled-up holiday pay was unlawful because it might deter workers from taking their paid annual leave, which it described as being a fundamental social right protected by the Working Time Directive. The Advocate General in Robinson Steele adopted a more subtle approach, which involved weighing up various factors in the construction of the rolled-up holiday pay arrangement, which would have had the result that some types of rolled-up holiday pay would have been okay and some wouldn't. What nobody noticed, not the Advocate General and not the court, was that the arrangement in Robinson Steele was collectively bargained. So this resulted from a collective agreement between the workers' union and the employer. And we can infer from that there must have been some sort of benefit to the workforce from this arrangement. So either they wanted the extra money more than they wanted the holiday, or the employer might have made some sort of other concession in order to obtain this agreement. So I'm not suggesting that the court's decision is necessarily wrong. As I've said, rolled-up holiday pay is a problematic practice, but the fact that nobody even noticed that it had been collectively bargained does seem rather strange. And it's a point that's been made forcefully in a very good note on Robinson Steele by my colleague Alan Bogg. We see a similar suspicion of collective bargaining in some other working time cases on the individual opt-out. And the cases I'm thinking of are SIMAP and FIFA. So the opt-out, as many of you will know, is the possibility that member states can invoke to allow workers to choose to work more than 48 hours in a week. It's something that the UK government defends very vigorously. In both SIMAP and FIFA, there were collective agreements in place which allowed workers to work longer than the 48-hour week. But the court ruled that it was not possible for the opt-out to be invoked in a collective agreement. And there is a textual basis for this, because if you look at Article 22 of the directive, it does refer to the worker's consent, so the worker in the singular. And again, that does seem to rather imply that we need consent from the individual worker rather than from the workers expressed through their trade union. However, in labour law, Workers do very often express their consent to things by collective means. That is a totally legitimate and accepted way of finding out what workers' preferences are. And there might be some advantages to it, the most obvious being that the individual worker is open to quite a lot of pressure to kind of cause him or her to sign an individual opt-out, whereas there might be some possibility through collective bargaining of insulating the worker from that kind of pressure. But again, the fact that this was included in a collective agreement wasn't really recognised, wasn't really taken into account. I think I've got time to just talk a little bit about discrimination cases before I move on. Discrimination's a really interesting area in terms of collective bargaining. If you go back to equal pay, it's very clear from the Equal Pay Directive that collective agreements are a proper subject of regulation. So just because a discriminatory clause is in a collective agreement doesn't insulate it from EU equal pay legislation. And in a case called Kowalska, the court extended that principle to what is now Article 157. So the treaty right to equal pay also applies to collective agreements. And I think that's, you know, that's all perfectly fine and legitimate. I don't think in an area so fundamental as sex discrimination, anybody would be suggesting that, well, because it's collectively bargained, it's okay. What's really fascinating, though, are some of the recent cases on age discrimination and the inclusion of retirement ages in collective agreements. Because what seems to be happening here is that the court is using the inclusion of the retirement age in a collective agreement as a factor in its favour, as a factor for regarding it as somehow legitimate and therefore accepting it as a proper way of setting a retirement age. And this is something that Claire Kilpatrick has noted in her work on the retirement age. There's a nice quote from Rosenblatt, which is one of these cases. By guaranteeing workers a certain stability of employment and in the long term the promise of foreseeable retirement, while offering employers a certain flexibility in the management of their staff, the clause on automatic termination of employment contracts is thus the reflection of a balance between diverging but legitimate interests against a complex background of employment relationships closely linked to political choices in the area of retirement and employment. And it goes on to make the point that the social partners, employers and trade unions, are well placed to balance up all those considerations, and so some deference might be shown to a retirement age because it's found in a collective agreement. However, I don't think we can infer from this that the court has experienced a sort of conversion to collective bargaining as a way of deciding things. I think it's as much a reflection of the court's own uncertainty about what to do about retirement ages. I think the acknowledgement of collective bargaining as a way of dealing with this is as much an acknowledgement of the court's real anxiety about what to do for the best, and delight at finding that there are some other people that it can legitimately palm this task off onto. So I think it's as much a recognition of the complexities of the topic as it is of the legitimacy of collective bargaining. Now, I've got a lot more in the paper about other examples involving collective bargaining and also some discussion of industrial action. But I'm going to move on to my second criterion in view of the time, and I'm going to focus on the court's regard for the practical consequences of its decisions. And I want to say something about costs of decisions and something about the practicalities of compliance. Those are my two points. So in terms of costs, the Court of Justice should be given some credit for being a court which is quite sensitive to the costs of its decisions. And you'll all know Dufresne, and you'll know that the court said that the decision would not have full retroactive effect because of the costs that it would impose that people might not have realised. And we find the same thing in the Barber decision on pensions. So there is a court showing regard for the practical consequences of its decisions. But let's contrast that then with the treatment of on-call time in the SIMAP case. This is a case about doctors who are on call. The court, again, emphasising that limitations on working time should be seen as fundamental rights for workers, regarded on-call time in that case as working time. And that is in itself a very pro-worker decision. The court is concerned that the directive should be effective in limiting people's working time. But what's happened since then? Well, what's happened since then is that lots more member states use the opt-out in the healthcare arena, because it's not possible just to suddenly magic up hundreds more doctors to cover the on-call time if everyone's working week is limited. And so, in fact, it's arguable that workers end up rather worse off as a result of that sort of decision than they were to start with, because there's probably even less regulation of their working time going on now that there's more of a possibility of opting out. And, of course, whereas the opt-out started out as very much a sort of concession to the UK, it's now quite widely used around the EU. So a mixed picture on costs, then. In terms of compliance, I want to do two quite different examples here. One from the Acquired Rights Directive, and a case that those of you who've studied this will know well, Susan, the case on what counts as a transfer of a business. So the Acquired Rights Directive deals with the situation in which the ownership of a business changes hands, and it's necessary to decide what constitutes an entity that is transferring for this purpose. There's a complex interaction here between the wording of the directive and the court's case law, but what the court has done is divided up businesses into asset-intensive businesses and labour-intensive businesses. If it's a labour-intensive business, you identify that a transfer has taken place by looking at whether the workers have transferred from the previous employer to the new employer. If it's asset intensive, you look at whether the assets have transferred. That all sounds quite straightforward on the surface, but think about it for a moment, and it's really quite ridiculous. So if you're trying to find out whether the workers have got security of employment because they've been transferred from the previous employer to the new employer, and it's a worker-intensive business and they haven't transferred, there's no transfer and they've got no rights under the directive. The reasoning is completely circular and means that an employer that wants to avoid a transfer situation has to identify, all they have to do is say, oh, well, this is a labour-intensive business, we won't transfer the workers, therefore, under the directive, no transfer has taken place. And my colleague Paul Davis has written some very trenchant criticism of that approach. So that's a decision where the practical consequences are pretty poor, actually, and quite obviously so when you pause to think about it. The other example that I just mentioned briefly would be the cases on positive discrimination or affirmative action, depending on your terminology. As you will probably know, the court changed its mind between Kalanka and Marshall about whether or not affirmative action was permitted. And we've ended up with this very limited version of affirmative action in which you can choose the candidate from the disadvantaged group if you've got two equally qualified candidates, provided that there's no other sort of justification for preferring the candidate from the advantaged group. Now, of course, it's inherent in the way that the court's rulings work that it's not there to give us a guide on how to do affirmative action, but equally that's not a ruling that's very easy to sort of implement international law, to give clear guidance to employers. And it would be quite understandable if member states reacted to that by saying, well, this is just too confusing and we're not going to bother. And until very recently, that was somewhat reflected in the UK's own position on this. So, for example, the court doesn't really tell us what sort of other considerations on the side of the person from the advantaged group might justify choosing them over the person from the disadvantaged group. So we're left with a ruling to try and reflect in national law, but it's really quite narrow. It's difficult to think how it would work in practice or to get the sort of detail that you might need in order to make that happen. So those are my examples. What I've been trying to show then is that the court's appreciation of labour market institutions, I've focused on collective bargaining, but there are other examples, is quite shaky, really, and it quite often gets it wrong. And in terms of the practical consequences of its decisions, it sometimes shows awareness of this in its rulings on costs of compliance, but other times makes decisions which, on a moment's reflection, have quite obviously bad and clearly unintended consequences, but pose problems in terms of practical implementation. There are two possible explanations or excuses or justifications or whatever you want to call them that we might give for these rulings, and I'd like to consider those before drawing some conclusions. One is that the court is just prioritising other factors over labour law issues. I haven't talked about Viking and Laval, but I mean that's certainly the argument that you would make in terms of those two cases. The court is prioritising free movement over industrial action, and that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do in terms of the structure of the treaty. But I don't think this explains all of the case law that I've been considering. It doesn't explain the working time cases, which are as sort of pure labour law issues as you might hope to find. Nor does the outcome in these cases excuse the sort of reasoning that we sometimes find along the way. So to give you an example from Viking, the court says, reflagging in that case is not a problem because the employer has given an undertaking that it will not cut the terms and conditions of the existing crew. But of course, we all know that employers reflag ships because they want to move to countries in which labour standards are lower. That's the point of reflagging. So there's a trap there, and the court falls neatly into it. So, yes, it's true that sometimes other factors are more important than labour law issues, but I don't think that excuses all the case law, or indeed all the assumptions made in the cases in which that applies. A second explanation, and I think this is a much more convincing one, is that the court is acting like a constitutional court, which is what we might expect it to do. I think it sees itself very much in that light. And it's emphasising individual rights. And this has quite powerful force, I think, in explaining the working time cases. So the court often refers to things like paid annual leave as fundamental social rights. And with the legal enforceability now of the EU Charter after Lisbon, it's doing that to an even greater extent because it can peg those sorts of rights closely to the Charter. I think it also helps to explain some of the affirmative action decisions where it's worried about individuals losing out to aims to protect groups. But that highlights one of the worries about this sort of approach. The court is quite selective in when it decides to focus on individual rights and to really prioritise them. The right to strike in Viking and Laval doesn't really play that much of a role. Job security doesn't really come into the reasoning in the cases on the Acquired Rights Directive. And a second concern I would have about this approach is the concern that labour lawyers have always had about individual rights approaches to their subject, that individual rights approaches can be very worker protective in their effects. They can be a very positive thing and are probably generally to be welcomed, but they can lead to a very strong emphasis on the individual, particularly at the expense of the collective. And that's what I think we're seeing in some of those cases, Simat Pfeiffer, for example, where the individual's choice is prioritised in terms of the opt-out, even though there might be benefits to allowing that choice to be made collectively. So, I don't like to just criticise, I like to try and be helpful and suggest solutions, and now I'm going to do that. And this, I think, is probably where the EU lawyers among you might have a bit of a heart attack, if you haven't had one already. So my first suggestion is, well, how about a specialist labour court? There go the heart attacks. Of course, the objection to this is all to do with the uniformity of EU law, which is why I worry about your reaction. But a specialist labour court, before I tell you why I don't think it's a good idea, is not a completely ludicrous suggestion. There is a power in the treaty to set up specialist courts. There is a specialist court, and it's the Civil Service Tribunal, which is a labour court. So, you know, there you go, there is one. So it's not a completely crazy idea. But there are these concerns about the uniformity of EU law and the sort of consistency of decisions across different subject areas. It's also the case that the workload is not terribly big, about 20 or 30 labour law cases per year, though it depends on how you define labour law cases for that purpose. If you want to take a broad view, you could include some other things, migration, free movement of workers, that sort of thing, which would get you a much bigger jurisdiction. But basically, the workload is quite small. Of course, the biggest problem would be a jurisdictional one. How do you decide what is a labour law case for these purposes? And again, I return to Viking and Laval, which you could call labour law cases, or you could call cases about free movement. So I think realistically, much as I'd love it, a specialist labour court isn't really going to work. A more plausible suggestion, and I think quite an interesting one, would be the use of the system of chambers in the court as a way of introducing a degree of specialisation. Now that there is a system of chambers, it seems to me to be not implausible to suggest that there might be a sort of social chamber which took the labour law cases and other cases in the sort of social policy field. Of course, ideally, you'd want to have specialist judges in those chambers, but I think imposing any constraints on the member states' selection of judges for these roles would be extremely difficult to achieve. So I think the best that you'd have to hope for is that you'd get generalists appointed, but they'd develop some expertise in the area over time as they decided more cases on the subject. My solutions get more plausible, but less good as they go on. So my third one, and this is something that is often raised in discussions about the court, is the idea of just giving more discretion to national courts. And there are lots of reasons why it might be a good thing for the Court of Justice to do this, but I think it would also help with my worry about deciding labour cases in a way which shows a good understanding of the institutional context and a good regard for practical consequences. It's not guaranteed that you'd be allowing discretion to a national court that would itself be a specialist court, but it might be a bit closer to the facts and circumstances, and giving it a bit more discretion might mean that at the end of the day you ended up with a decision that was kind of a better fit with conditions on the ground. And of course, the fact that in labour law we're primarily dealing with directives as the main legislative instrument, I think rather reinforces the point that some degree of discretion would be a good idea. To conclude then, I've been critical of the court, I've suggested some solutions. I said right at the beginning that these problems might not be unique to labour law and that other subjects might make similar claims. And indeed they might, and as I said, I'm not qualified to assess that. And I think from the perspective of EU law, that might seem a rather scary prospect, that lots of people like me are going to show up in different areas saying, we want to do things our way. But I think there comes a point where And I think I would see it as a maturing, really, of EU law, where there's an acceptance of the fact that as EU law has expanded into a range of different areas, there might be, in fact, some justification for allowing a bit of divergence, a bit of specialisation, that we can't really talk in a sensible way about a whole uniform thing called EU law anymore. And I wouldn't see that as a threatening prospect. I think I'd want to see that as a sign of maturity and confidence. And on that positive note, I'll stop. Thank you for listening.